Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum, joined by the second most handsome doctor in North America, Dr. Austin Baraki, fresh out of the hospital and right into your ears. What's going on, man?
I suppose that's true.
Yeah, that's true.
We're on a good roll these days. That's good.
Yeah. You know, when I eventually put these on YouTube, people are going to notice that fresh haircut you have. It's very like FPJ. And for those of you who are too young to know that reference, that's Freddie Prinze Jr. And
I didn't realize these are going on YouTube, but
I'm just stockpiling
myself more.
No, I think this is perfect. Yeah, you got the headset on, you're ready to play Call of Duty afterwards. FPJ, who knew he was a physician? Yeah. Okay, we're gonna talk about a new practice changing guideline for your ticker today. It's all about heart health. We're going to get into that in just a second, but first, a few announcements. Thing one, of course, the Barbell Medicine app is available in the Apple App Store. This podcast is probably brought to you, you know, indirectly by the Barbell Medicine app, and it's free. And we have all of our training materials, all of our resources. You can get all that stuff, both the free stuff, and then if you need some extra help, we do that too through the app. Just go to the Apple App Store and search Barbell Medicine. You can get that. If you are a green bubble person, green text person, we'll get to you soon. I promise. It's in the works and we will announce it. We're not just going to release it and then hope you find it. And if you are looking for the rest of our information, we got articles over on our website. We have a bunch of videos on YouTube. We got podcasts. So if this is your first podcast you've ever listened to in the Barbell Medicine series, well, we got 190 at least other ones. And I think that count is off because all of the pain and rehab ones I put as different numbers until I realized that like no one was keeping track. So I think, I mean, we're over 200, but I did want to pose this question to you. When we get to the actual, like, I'm going to name it episode 200, I feel like we need to celebrate. We didn't do anything for our century, you know, the 100, but 200 means, and we've been doing this for almost 4 years.
Has it been that long, man? I'm not sure how we should celebrate, but I trust you.
Should we shut it all down? Just be like, it's been too long.
Just start at the beginning, you know. Reset.
I think what we'll do is we'll just get a bunch of guests to come in and tell us how cool we are. And I think that people will really enjoy hearing from other people besides us. Also, in case you missed our last podcast, that was on the August research review, and the podcast before that was on progressive loading. We actually have an article up on the website by Dr. Austin Baraki and myself on progressive loading. If you're trying to figure out how much weight should you add to the bar and when and like why, that's the article. That is our magnus opus on the topic as of this moment. So check that out. That is linked in the description below. And also, if you want to come to one of our live in-person seminars, we have a gaggle of seminars coming up. I mean, it went from 0 to 100 real quick. We've got at least 4 live events scheduled in the next calendar year. So it will be in Los Angeles in November for our regular 2-day health and performance barbell medicine seminar. That's myself, Dr. Baraki, the rest of the BBM crew. If you want to lift, you want to learn about all things pertaining to health and performance, that's your seminar. We also have another one of those seminars in Atlanta at Alpha Strength and Power. That's in February of 2023. And then we'll be in New York at CrossFit South Brooklyn in May. And our pain and rehab folks, they're back on it as well. They're going to be in Miami in January and can confirm that Miami in January is quite pleasant. We were there. What was that? Was that 2020? Was that before the world shut down?
I think it was 19 when we were there for New Year's.
Yeah, I think it was 19 to 20.
Oh, like, yeah.
That was
sure.
The turnover. Yes.
Yeah.
I'm still salty about that because my toothbrush ended up on the living room floor when the people broke into our Airbnb and stole my DOP and all Tom's electronics. But I was really bummed about that toothbrush. In any case, yeah. So we have a couple live events. If you're interested in attending, they're meant for health professionals, fitness professionals, or just training enthusiasts or people who are training curious. I mean, we've had people who've literally never lifted come to our seminars before, which is really cool because then they can do the squat, the bench, the deadlift, the press, learn all about the benefits, how to structure it. And people say when it's their like introduction to this, they leave the seminar, they're like, I feel ready to do this. And I'm like, well, good, because we just, you know, we gave you the keys to the city, and yeah, people seem to really like it. Okay, Austin, we're gonna do this, man. We're gonna trigger the internet. I feel it. This podcast is really gonna. If people listen to it, who are the carnivore bros, the anti seed oil bros, the cholesterol doesn't matter bros. I feel like, but I don't know why they'd be listening to this podcast. You know what I'm saying? They kind of know where we stand, so why would you listen? But hey, if you're here, we're happy to have you. We're going to talk about this for the next 30, 45 minutes. So again, this podcast, episode 191, I'm here with Dr. Austin Baracchi, is all about a new practice-changing guideline for your heart. Okay, this came out at the European Society of Cardiology conference that was 2 weeks ago or something like that. The paper was presented. Then I think it came out maybe a week beforehand. So Austin, what was the paper and what is this about?
So the title, for those who are interested, it was published in the August 22 edition of the European Heart Journal, and it's an open access article, meaning it's one of those rare scientific papers that you can actually just look up and read. You don't have to pay or access through other means. And so the title of this paper is Lipoprotein little a in Atherosclerotic Cardiovascular Disease and Aortic Stenosis, a European Atherosclerosis Society Consensus Statement. So the European Atherosclerosis Society's consensus statements are kind of a big deal in the cardiovascular world. We've cited several of their other ones in the past on other topics. And so this one is on a topic that we have actually never explicitly discussed in any of our content, in any of our stuff on relating to cholesterol, heart disease, any of those things. And it's principally because this is a very, relatively speaking, a younger and more rapidly evolving area of research. And we didn't really have enough information or consensus on the topic to like comment really confidently on it. And I still wouldn't say that this episode is going to be full of very confident claims, but it is, I think, reached a point where it is definitely important enough for us to address specifically. And in addition, because it is something that for the healthcare practitioners out there, my bias, I'm starting to come around to the idea that this should probably be impacting practice, which means it is justifiable to talk about at this point.
Yeah. And then, you know, if you're listening to the Barbell Medicine podcast, you're at least health curious, right? You're like interested certainly in your own health, but then also maybe like pro longevity. Let's live like a full and complete life and, you know, compressed morbidity, all of that stuff. And so this is at some point going to become relevant to either your life, your client's life, your parents' lives, like whatever. So this is pretty interesting. I do think that they could have done a better job with the title. Like, you just missed opportunity for like lipoprotein Lil A coming at you with the new drop. And it's like, how many syllables are in that title? Anyway, all right. So we're going to get into what lipoprotein little a is here in a second. But first, since we are talking about quote unquote heart health and a particular subsection of that known as atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, which we abbreviate often as ASCVD. What is that, Austin? Like, what does that umbrella term refer to? And, you know, just give people a lay of the land here.
Yeah, so the heart, we'll start real big picture. It's a very complex organ. And so when you say somebody has heart disease, you know, if to take that literally, there are lots of different diseases that people can have that impact the heart. The one that people most often are describing is atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease impacting the heart, although this can extend throughout the entire body. And so atherosclerosis is this process by which the blood vessels that carry blood either to the heart muscle itself or to other areas of our body, which is obviously very important to deliver oxygen, to deliver nutrients so our organs can live and function and adapt and do all the cool things they do. When those vessels become hardened, they become thickened, and that process is related to the deposition of fatty components to include cholesterol, which develop into plaques in the walls of our blood vessels. And that can cause inflammation and narrowing of the blood vessels over time. It can cause these plaques can rupture and a clot can form in that area. And that can block off blood flow completely. That's when things like what is known commonly as a heart attack or more clinically as a myocardial infarction happens, where not enough blood flow is actually getting to the heart muscle, and part of your heart muscle can potentially die if that's left untreated. This can also impact other areas of the body if these plaques develop in the blood vessels that feed your brain, and a similar process can happen. A heart attack of the brain is what people know as a stroke, or similarly, blood vessels that feed other areas of the body, in particular the legs, such that people can end up having progressively impaired or, you know, completely cut off blood flow to the lower limbs, such that that can lead to a need for amputation and other kind of emergency interventions and things like that to save people's lives. So atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease is and remains the leading cause of death worldwide and in the U.S. It beats cancer as number two, which is number two. And it beats this by a fair amount, and it has been that way for a long time. The rates of this cardiovascular disease, you know, death from cardiovascular disease have actually been decreasing on a like per 100,000 population basis in the U.S., for example, which is related to a variety of you know, public health interventions and medications and all things that that we are doing a little bit better nowadays. But it is still, you know, for sure the most common cause of death. And even if you don't die from it, the complications of it that don't kill you that you may continue to live with, for example, somebody could have a heart attack that doesn't kill them, but that can weaken the heart muscle enough to leave them with long-term heart failure, which is another extremely common situation. I have several patients that I'm treating for heart failure in the hospital as we speak right now. It's a very common thing that I deal with, or long-term complications of stroke or long-term complications of these amputations, et cetera, et cetera. So ultimately, big picture, you know, our blood vessels are really important to take oxygenated and nutrient-rich blood to various areas of our body. When those become hardened, thickened, inflamed, and potentially blocked off by plaques and clots, then that can cause potentially catastrophic complications to include death or long-term disability. And so that's what we're talking about here.
10 out of 10, would not recommend. Yes. Now, there are a ton of different risk factors for heart disease, and broadly you can categorize them into non-modifiable ones. So things like age, genetics, family history, can't really do anything about those, but they definitely contribute. And, you know, you could come up with various risk scores or hazard scores, you know, depending on how clinically, you know, biased your research is. If you're reading a bunch of medical papers, you're going to be very familiar with those things. If you're reading mainstream media articles, maybe not so much. But in any case, the non-modifiable risk factors are just in general things you can't really do anything about. Whereas there are modifiable risk factors that do kind of change the playing field here. And the American Heart Association just came out with their Essential 8. This is an update to about a 12-year-old sort of a piece that they put together. It was like the Essential 7 or the, you know, so they added another component. So there are 8 components that are modifiable, that modify your risk for heart disease. So these include things like a healthy diet, so that health-promoting dietary pattern we always talk about, that's that. Participation in physical activity, so having sufficient levels of physical activity, which does include resistance training. Avoidance of nicotine. Healthy sleep, which is a huge umbrella thing. Just like, yeah, you should sleep. We're like, oh, thank you for that, American Heart Association. Maintaining a healthy weight and body composition. Healthy levels of blood lipids and blood glucose, and also blood pressure. So these are things that you can actually modify via behavioral change and various other processes to reduce your risk of heart disease. And we're going to focus today on blood lipids. I've linked this Essential 8 paper also in the description below if you want to read up more on that. And there are some cool handouts and graphics associated with that. But we're going to focus on healthy levels of blood lipids, and in particular, a very specific marker of blood lipids. So when we say lipids, Austin, and we're talking about blood work, you know, I got to go get my bloods done before the doctor. They're going to do a standard lipid panel in general. If you ask for one, like, nobody's going to say no. So what's in that? What is it measuring? And then what is this lipoprotein little A? So like, let's tie the room together here.
Yeah. So lipids is just a fancy chemistry term describing things that don't dissolve in water. And that biologically refers to things like fats and cholesterol and a variety of other substances. And since our bloodstream is mostly water, those substances don't dissolve in our blood. And so in order to be transported around, they need to be carried on various proteins that will help them get around, because otherwise they'd have a really hard time not being able to dissolve in the water-based bloodstream. And so here we're going to focus mostly on cholesterol as the kind of lipid substance that needs to be carried around on these proteins. And so these proteins are known as lipoproteins, and there's a variety of them. And they're classified by their density. And so there are, for example, high density lipoproteins, that's known as HDL, that may show up on your on your cholesterol panel. There are low density lipoproteins, those will show up as LDL on your lipid panel. And so when you go and you get a regular old cholesterol panel measured, it will measure at least in the U.S., and we'll use U.S. units, even though these units will change in other countries, but a basic cholesterol panel will measure the total mass, the total amount of cholesterol in terms of a concentration. So in the U.S. Labs, it'll be milligrams of cholesterol per deciliter of blood. So milligrams of cholesterol per like a tenth of a liter of blood. It'll measure the total amount of cholesterol as well as the amount of cholesterol being carried by your high density lipoproteins. That's known as HDL-C, or HDL cholesterol. It'll measure the amount of triglycerides, again, in terms of a concentration, milligrams per deciliter, or again, that's at least in U.S. units. And then there are various estimation or calculation formulas that will use those numbers to estimate, calculate a low density lipoprotein or an LDL cholesterol. And so we have talked about this on our prior episodes, and I've discussed these in detail in the three-part cholesterol article series on our website that we've gotten a lot of great feedback on. People have found that very useful and applied it to their own situations, which is great. And so if this is all brand new to you, I would recommend you go to those articles, particularly start with just Google Barbell Medicine Cholesterol Part 1 and take it away from there. It's written for general audience, regular folks, to try to understand that. And so that is the most common or typical cholesterol panel that is measured in standard practice. There are tons of additional lipid-related markers that can be measured, and these have wildly varying utility. Some are much more useful, and some are completely unhelpful, but are often done anyway because it makes it seem like you're doing more thorough testing and people are willing to pay for stuff that seems more thorough and more fancy and more advanced as well. And so ultimately, again, we've talked about how this process works as it relates to cardiovascular disease in our prior podcast on the topic. I think one of them, we even had Alan Flanagan on as well, or Dr. Flanagan, newly minted PhD. And this is also discussed in our articles. And so the idea here is that the standard cholesterol panel measures the amount of cholesterol being carried on these lipoproteins in a given volume of blood. However, the actual risk of cardiovascular disease or heart disease developing as it relates to cholesterol has more to do with the number of these lipoprotein particles, the concentration of these lipoprotein particles that are circulating in the blood. The higher the concentration of these lipoprotein particles, particularly the low density lipoprotein, the LDL particles, the higher the concentration, the more of those particles we have around, and the longer that exposure is happening for over the course of your life, the higher somebody's individual risk of heart disease will be from the standpoint of cholesterol. Again, as you mentioned, there are a bunch of other risk factors that can contribute to influence drive heart disease risk. But insofar as, you know, we ultimate pathway for plaque to develop in the arteries is for these particles, these lipoprotein particles to get into the walls of our blood vessels, deposit their cholesterol, that generates a downstream cascade of inflammation and plaque development and things like that. The higher the amount of these particles there are swimming around, and the longer that goes on for, the higher the risk. And conversely, the earlier in life we can get these down into healthy ranges, the earlier in life we can get them under control, the lower somebody's risk is. And this is also mirrored by genetic data. People who are born with genetically high levels, they develop heart disease very early in life. And people who are born genetically with extremely low levels have upwards of a 90%+ reduced risk of developing heart disease ever in their lifespan, which is kind of awesome if you have that.
Yeah. Just to reiterate, we're not talking about the size of the particles. We're not talking about any ratios like HDL to LDL ratio or any sort of other numbers. We're literally just talking about the amount of LDL, low density lipoprotein, cholesterol in your blood. The more that you have, the higher that number is, which you can deduce from a standard lipid panel, portends a greater risk of cardiovascular disease, atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease. And so if you were to get a standard lipid panel, so no additional testing, specialized testing, the executive physical or whatever, you know, you send out a couple $1,000 and get all these, you know, other tests pulled back, you could get a pretty good picture of what somebody's risk for atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease just based on a standard lipid panel. If their LDL was through the roof, you'd be like, huh, I feel like they're at an increased risk. You may want some additional testing just to kind of clarify if there's any gray zone in there. And that's what we're going to talk about today. So this new practice changing guideline like you mentioned earlier, is about lipoprotein little A, which I will refer to as Lil A because, you know, he's dropping the hottest beat since 2022. And what is lipoprotein little A? Because we've got LDL, we've got HDL, you know, that people are familiar with. They've also probably heard of triglycerides. But what is lipoprotein little A?
Okay. So yeah, the caveat up front, this is the rapidly evolving area of research that we're talking about. This has changed pretty dramatically over the past 10 to 15 years. And so things will change over the coming years. We may say some things that end up kind of needing refinement over time, but I think we're at a point where we have enough information to speak on this topic and try to bring people up to date. And at least it was enough for me to impact my practice in the past couple of years as well. So, as I mentioned earlier, we are most concerned with, from a general, you know, cholesterol panel, we're most concerned with the low density lipoproteins, the number of those particles there are in the blood. The regular cholesterol panel doesn't actually measure how many of those low density lipoprotein particles there are in the blood. It measures how much cholesterol is being carried on them. And that gives us an imperfect estimate of that. Again, as you said, when that number is sky high, somebody's LDL cholesterol is 300 or something milligrams per deciliter, 400 plus, that's like getting into real, you know, high risk territory. And it's safe to assume in a lot of those situations that their number of particles they have to carry that amount of cholesterol is also quite high. There are some people where there's some mismatch between the two numbers, but that's getting into a little bit more advanced territory. The bottom line is that we're most concerned with these low density lipoprotein particles. These particles are made in the liver. And in general, the way we identify them is both by their density, but also because they have this kind of surface protein on them. And the surface protein is called ApoB. And ApoB is an example of a surface protein on these lipoprotein molecules that basically directs where they go and what they can do in the body. That's what interacts with things in the tissues that facilitate its kind of action. Different lipoprotein particles like HDL, for example, that has a different protein on its surface that drives it to do different functions. That has something called Apo capital A on it. And so those kind of surface proteins, be it ApoB or Apo capital A or whatever the case is, can influence how these particles function and how they behave in the body. Now, in recent years, we have identified the risk that is conferred by this particle called lipoprotein little a, and we just say little because it's a lowercase a. And the reason it's called that is because it is very, very similar to a regular old low-density lipoprotein or a regular old LDL particle that has an ApoB on it. But in addition, it has this additional little protein on it called Apo little a. And when we say little again, it's just a lowercase, Apo little a. So if you take an LDL particle, which normally has ApoB on it, and the liver makes and spits out an Apo little a part of a protein onto the surface of this particle as well, suddenly we have a different kind of species of lipoprotein called lipoprotein little a. And so that's the bottom line particle that we are talking about in this guideline. And the reason it is being discussed and the reason it has a whole guideline around it, the reason it's important is because it actually plays a pretty significant role in heart disease risk when it is elevated, and it is not something that would be measured or show up on a regular cholesterol panel. This particle actually came into a little bit of, you know, public awareness in the news a couple years back when, what's his name, Bob Harper, the guy who was the fitness coach for The Biggest Loser, who would otherwise, by all appearances, be quite healthy and presumably had a pretty good-looking cholesterol panel, actually had a heart attack, and he was found to have actually markedly elevated levels of lipoprotein little a, and that was thought to be a pretty major contributor or driver of his risk of having a heart attack when everything else seemed to look okay.
Yeah, so this is like a protein tag, basically just attached to the lipoprotein. And as my recollection, which is imperfect, of course, about 20, 25 years ago, we developed tests to actually identify, you know, seek out this protein in a blood test. Now, it's not on the standard lipid panel, but the test was available and mostly used in research just to kind of see like, oh, what does this lipoprotein little a do? And like, what is it associated with? You know, that was 20, 25 years ago. And over the interim time, it's been correlated more and more and more and strongly with an increased risk of, you know, heart disease. And so I think now what you're describing is this critical mass of like data and like how it's been sorted and chopped up or whatever to say, wow, we can actually measure this and sort of get a better picture of people who might not actually have like an abnormal lipid panel result, but still be at an increased risk of cardiovascular disease just because of the lipoprotein little A levels. Is that kind of where we're going with this?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, I think because of how complex the biology is of this molecule, you know, regular old LDL is nice and simple. It has one ApoB on the surface, one of those proteins. And even if you can order a separate blood test just called an ApoB level. And since there's one of those ApoBs on every LDL, if you measure just the number of ApoBs in the blood, then boom, you have a particle count for how many total low density lipoproteins there are in the blood. With Apo little a, it adds a lot of complexity because people can express this protein to varying ways. And the protein itself is kind of like it has like a tail, and that tail can have varying lengths. And that is something that is actually quite difficult to discern on from a laboratory measurement standpoint. You have like, you're measuring this one particle, but it looks a bunch of different ways in different people. So how do you have like a standardized test for this kind of thing? So that's why like early on the tests were not great. And we had a hard time teasing out like, how does this actually relate to risk? Whereas now more, you know, we have better and better tests that are able to more accurately measure the number of particles we have, which is the preferred way of testing this in the blood. And that is now being shown obviously more and more tightly correlated with long-term risk.
Okay. So if you have, what is a normal level of lipoprotein little a, and like what's elevated, and what does that mean for somebody who has it?
Yeah. So this is, I think that with all of these lipoproteins, even on a regular cholesterol panel, if you were to measure an ApoB level, if you're going to measure a lipoprotein little a level, any of these things, in medicine, unfortunately, we often have to like somewhat arbitrarily dichotomize into normal and abnormal, even though a lot of things function on spectrums. And so this is, just like these other things, a spectrum in terms of, you know, it's a continuous spectrum of risk, meaning the higher you go from very, very low levels, there is detectable increases in risk over the very long term. However, we do have to set some numbers someplace to give people a sense. Now, the only other caveat I'll add is that there are two different ways of measuring these lipoprotein little a levels. And I mention it because depending on if people get them tested, they may get one result or the other. If it is measuring the mass of these particles, you know, how the mass of them will be reported, at least in the US, in milligrams per deciliter, kind of like we measure the mass of cholesterol on a regular cholesterol panel. The other way that it can be measured, and this is actually a little bit more preferable, is to measure the number of these particles there are in the blood rather than their mass. And if you measure the number of particles, then it gets reported in nanomoles per liter, NMOL per liter. And so depending on which units you get on your lab test, you can tell whether, oh, this is measuring the mass of them or this is measuring the number of particles. Both have utility. If I had to, you know, to pick, I would prefer the one that measures the number of particles, but both can tell us basically what we need to know. So if we're measuring the mass of particles, if the LP little a or lipoprotein little a level is below 30 milligrams per deciliter, we feel pretty good about that. That seems to be pretty clearly in a low risk range. As levels increase above 50 milligrams per deciliter, then we start to get more concerned. Area in between, somewhat of a gray zone. That's the best, you know, I can do short of giving somebody just a completely, you know, arbitrary dichotomy right in the middle of say 40 or something like that. So below 30, I feel good. Above 50, the higher it goes, I feel worse. And then in between is a little bit of a gray zone. That's if we're measuring the mass in milligrams per deciliter. If we're measuring the number of these particles, again, it'll be reported in nanomoles per liter, and roughly 2.5 times higher will be those numbers. So the bottom end of the range instead of 30 is more like 75 nanomoles per liter. If it's 75 nanomoles per liter or less, we feel pretty good about that. If it's 125 nanomoles per liter or higher, again, 2.5 times ish 50, then we feel increasingly more concerned the higher it goes above that. And in between that range is a bit of a gray area. So those are kind of the ranges that we think about depending on whether we're measuring mass of these particles or the number of them that are in the blood, just depending on the test that you have available to you.
So if you have a high number of these, you know, LP little a particles, you're over 125 nanomoles per liter. Why is that a problem?
Yeah, so as it turns out, these particles, their biology, again, is not perfectly understood for sure. It's very complex. It is unclear the any physiological role that they may have. There's been some hypotheses about, like, do they play a role in scavenging oxidized lipids from other places in the body? Do they have a role in wound healing? Do they have a role in – there's a variety of things that are thrown out there. ultimately, though, what seems to be the case is that the higher these concentrations are and the longer they're elevated for, similar to regular old lipoproteins, that confers a higher risk of multiple types of cardiovascular disease. So these appear to be pro-inflammatory. They are pro-thrombotic, meaning they promote clotting. They are pro-calcifying. And in general, they ultimately seem to drive atherosclerosis. And so these effects, again, are thought to be related to these particles' ability to carry certain types of lipids that are chemically modified, that are oxidized, which is a fancy chemistry term that we don't need to get into great detail on. But these are lipids that seem to have, like, particularly if they get deposited into vessel walls and things like that, have a much stronger propensity to drive the inflammation cascade and contribute to plaque development and plaque rupture and things like that. And as it turns out, that on a per particle basis, these seem to be riskier than regular old LDL particles, which is a problem since they don't show up on regular cholesterol tests, regular cholesterol panels.
Right. So little A's dropping the hottest beats and the most aggressive beats in your vessel wall compared to LDL. So, but that, I think, actually becomes a more clarifying statement, right? So the standard lipid panel, you get an LDL level, right? It's not measured directly or whatever. It's kind of it is an indirect measurement. It gives you kind of a picture of what you're doing there. And so you could have somebody with a normal LDL, you know, but you're still, I'm not as confident as I'd like to be. And so you can order additional tests to sort of clarify, you know, if somebody is at an increased risk or not. And so you could, for example, order an ApoB, apolipoprotein B, and all of these LDL and other atherogenic, so causing maybe or contributing to plaque formation, you could order a test that measures all of those particles, and that would give you additional information. And then you could order an additional test, lipoprotein little a in this case, to get even more information, which you wouldn't have otherwise gotten. So, like, what, in your view, like, what is the difference between these things, lipoprotein little a, apolipoprotein B, LDL, as from like a clinical standpoint? Because you can get them at different levels of the game, right? So, like, how are you looking at this picture?
So I think that you can look at this over the course of the past 100 years, say, and see how things have evolved. So, like, the first thing that was ever identified was, if we measure just total cholesterol levels in the blood, the mass of cholesterol total, without any further refinement, there is some relationship between that and heart disease risk, especially as levels get much, much, much higher. And then as the science advanced and the clinical kind of lab chemistry abilities improved, we were able to differentiate instead of just total cholesterol on everything. We were able to identify, in particular, higher levels of these, in particular, these low-density lipoproteins, these LDL particles, the more cholesterol they carry, that seems to be the more tightly related to risk rather than overall total cholesterol. And then it was refined even further, where we're like, the total number of LDL particles, rather than the amount of cholesterol they carry, seems to be the biggest driver of risk. We're refining it even more. And the best way to estimate the total number of LDL particles is by measuring this ApoB level. So this is providing additional refinement. And now we have this, like, cousin type lipoprotein of LDL known as lipoprotein little a, which also confers risk on its own, kind of independent of regular old, you know, ApoB, regular old LDL particles. And so this is kind of another way to assess for, additional risk factors that would not be detected through routine testing. So you can get a regular old cholesterol panel. Again, that'll measure the amount of cholesterol being carried on these lipoproteins. A more refined measurement would be the number of them that there are. That would be best done with an ApoB level. And then to get additional, you know, this kind of cousin independent risk of lipoprotein A, that needs its own separate measurement.
So would it be possible for somebody to have a normal calculated LDL, a normal apolipoprotein B level, but an abnormal elevated level of lipoprotein little a?
I believe so. Yes.
Yeah,
I believe
that's so. That's what I've read as well. So it's like this whole thing. It's, again, if you have somebody with a wildly elevated LDL, like, you don't really need to go any further. You know, you've already identified, wow, there's some increased risk here. But if it's kind of in that gray zone, it's not really elevated, but you still have additional questions, you can order additional testing. And it sounds like where we're getting is that, yeah, there's further levels of refinement with these additional tests. So here's the question, Austin. What determines how much lipoprotein little a I've got floating around? Like, how do I get this? How do I avoid it? What's going on there?
Yeah, that's ultimately the bottom line that we would all like to know, of course. And so on our previous podcast relating to cholesterol, we talked about all the lifestyle factors that can influence blood lipid levels. We talked about dietary factors, you know, the balance of saturated and unsaturated fats in the diet, the amount of fiber in the diet, insulin resistance, body fat levels, all these other kind of things that can influence it. With lipoprotein little a, it seems that at least 90% of the amount of this that there is in the blood seems to be conferred by genetics. And it turns out that in more or less approximately, people will achieve their adult level of this in the blood by around 5 years old, which is scary, right? there can be some a little bit further increase from there, but in general, that's kind of more or less an age where people will be expressing this kind of gene fully to the extent they're going to express it and have essentially their adult levels. There can be some impact of diet, which is a little bit paradoxical, or I don't know if paradoxical is the right word. It's just interesting in that it is precisely the opposite of the dietary factors that influence regular LDL and regular cholesterol panel information. So levels can fluctuate 10-15% or so, something like that, where consuming a low carbohydrate and high saturated fat diet will tend to decrease levels of lipoprotein little a bit, maybe 10%, something like that. Whereas we know that that will markedly increase levels of the other lipoproteins, the increased levels of LDL, for example. And so, you know, somebody might think, oh, well, maybe I should do that kind of a diet to lower my LP little a. Well, as it turns out, there are like quadrillions of LDL particles in the blood. And if you're markedly increasing that by pursuing that kind of a diet, the increase in risk that you get significantly increasing LDL levels may outweigh a small decrease that you get by lowering LP little a. So I would not recommend that kind of dietary approach. And even independently of just like hypothesizing, oh, it seems like that might work, we can just look at, again, actual outcomes and see that people actually do worse when they pursue that kind of a diet on a number of fronts.
Well, yeah. And then additionally, when you go to lower lipoprotein little a, when you try to do that, particularly with pharmaceutical interventions, it seems to be like a critical mass. You need to lower them by like 40 or 50% to get
a lot.
The needle to move.
Yeah.
So like, all right, yeah. If you lowered it 10% via the diet, it's like, oh yeah, okay. It's kind of like pissing in the ocean or farting in the wind.
Yeah.
Like what are you doing? And in addition, you're likely increasing your risk from other factors. So it's like, don't rob Peter to pay Paul here from a dietary component. But it is interesting that that does affect these levels. And actually, there's going to be some more interesting stuff with lipoprotein little a with respect to exercise. We're going to get to that shortly. But it seems like you're saying that this is mostly genetically driven. Like your whatever genetic hand you're dealt, this is kind of determining your lipoprotein little a levels. If they're high, so somebody's got a high level, what do you do with that?
Yeah, so that's a situation where because it's so genetically driven and because it is quite tightly related to risk of things like heart attack, stroke, heart failure, heart disease, death, things like that, it actually turns out that this is probably the highest genetic driver of heart disease risk that people can inherit. Of course, there are a variety of other risks that you can kind of acquire over the course of your lifespan, for example, through smoking or something like that. But it's estimated that about 20% of the population have levels that fall into a high risk range, which is a lot.
That's a lot.
It turns out that this varies by ethnicity. And so those of African ancestry seem to have the highest levels, whereas those of Chinese or Japanese ancestry tend to have the lowest levels. And this is all kind of like on average, there's a fair amount of variability between. And I don't know that we have a great explanation for all of this. But again, like 20% overall is pretty concerning. And if for individuals who have very high levels of this lipoprotein little a, it can actually match the risk that people would have if they had untreated familial hypercholesterolemia, which is the genetic condition that drives your LDL to be very high. You can end up with kind of like a risk equivalent if you have very high levels of LP little a, like over 180 milligrams per deciliter or something like that. And remember, I said that like 125 is kind of the upper end where it's like, once it gets above this, I'm definitely much more concerned. So there's tons of variables that impact whether people who have high LP little a levels will actually develop disease. The way this is expressed or the way this ultimately manifests in people is pretty variable. This is kind of the concept of like disease penetrance is kind of variable. So not every, just like anything else, right? Some people smoke their whole lives and don't get lung cancer. Some people do. Some people have high cholesterol levels and don't develop heart disease. Some people, you know, many people do. But the overall relationship that we see is quite clear and consistent. It is just a bit variable from person to person. So the bottom line here, as far as what do we do about it, how do we deal with this lipoprotein? And that's kind of where this guideline caught my attention, how it all, you know, over the past, year, 2 years or something like that has actually started to impact my practice more. So we've established that this is overwhelmingly genetically driven. You tend to reach your adult levels by about 5 years of age. And we have this very consistent paradigm in the world of blood lipids as they relate to heart disease that, again, the higher the levels are and the longer they're elevated for, the higher risk that ends up giving you. Conversely, the earlier in life you can get them under control, and the longer you can keep them controlled for, the lower your risk. That applies to both regular lipoproteins, regular LDL, and lipoprotein little a. And so since you reach your adult levels essentially by age 5, the European and Canadian guidelines on this topic for clinicians are now recommending that all adults should get screened once in their lifetime. At some point, get it checked. The idea being that since it is overwhelmingly genetically driven and all these other lifestyle things have much more minor impacts on levels, if you get it checked once and it is in a, you know, very low risk range below that like 30 milligrams or 75 nanomoles levels, then you're good, right? It's unlikely that this is going to somehow skyrocket into a very high risk range and you're good to go from the standpoint of this particular lipoprotein. Conversely, if you get it checked and it's very high, then that's a situation where it's like, okay, now we're especially concerned about this individual as far as their risk goes from the standpoint of this particle. And so ultimately, what you should end up doing is getting an overall risk assessment done with your doctor. They may be familiar with how to do this. They may be unfamiliar with how to do this in many cases, I think. So there's a handy resource that's been provided that I'm sure we can link. It literally, the web address is lpaclinicalguidance.com. And this website basically is a way of pulling together multiple of these risk factors to include some of the things that you mentioned in the healthy eight. So height, weight, which it'll, you know, use a BMI, your basic lipid panel measurement, your blood pressure measurements, smoking history, diabetes history, family history, things like that. And from that, it'll use validated, you know, risk prediction scores to spit out a risk estimate based on your regular risk factors that you have. And then by punching in what is the LP little a measurement that I have gotten, it can say what is the additional risk that you have from this particle? And therefore, what should we do to manage that risk as best as possible? So the bad news is a couple things. One, again, is that this is primarily genetically driven. And the second is that at this very moment, we do not have direct treatments that can very potently lower levels of lipoprotein little a. So I don't have something that can immediately lower it. Although there are several medications that are in phase 2 or phase 3 trials that we're anticipating clinical results from in the coming, you know, couple years. But the idea is that, hey, we should not be, you know, if we have a way to reduce your risk, there's no benefit to letting you live untreated for longer if you have this risk factor. And so that means that even if your other risk factors are not in crazy high risk ranges, so even if your regular cholesterol panel is not in a crazy high risk range, even if your blood pressure is not in a crazy high risk range, since we know that those other things, they drive risk, again, in a kind of continuous fashion, there's not a binary normal, abnormal, then that means that the lower we drive all those other things, then that will ultimately help to lower your overall risk. So in other words, the bottom line is for somebody who has very elevated lipoprotein little a levels, I would probably treat their regular cholesterol panel, treat their blood pressure, things like that, more aggressively and to lower targets than I would for somebody who did not have a very high lipoprotein little a level. Does that make sense?
You're reducing the risk factors from other things that we know not only affect the score, but that also we can modify without what we have currently available to us. So effectively, we lack something we can use to directly attack this thing, but indirectly we can make a difference. And that's kind of why this consensus came out. So
exactly. So I think some of the takeaways are like everybody should get screened once and use that information to get an overall risk estimate. And based on that risk estimate, then we can potentially more aggressively treat the regular cholesterol levels. We can treat blood pressure. We can treat things like that. And some of the important caveats here. So that may mean that somebody receives or is recommended to take something like a statin or take ezetimibe or something like that. And it is true that in some individuals, there's variable responsiveness to all of these treatments. But in some people, taking a statin may actually slightly increase their LP little a levels. Again, similar to what we mentioned with diet earlier, is that overall, we see risk decrease from these medicines. And that's probably because it has a much more potent effect on lowering the much bigger number of LDL particles in the blood compared to what it does to a slight increase in Lp(a) levels. So overall, we're working with the overall balance of risk here. And then some of the other more modern medicines, like to include PCSK9 inhibitors and things like that, those can actually directly lower lipoprotein little a levels a bit, but those are extremely difficult to get covered specifically for this reason, unless somebody has already had multiple heart attacks or multiple strokes or something like that before. So medication treatment directed at this lipoprotein, we don't have at this very moment, although I expect we probably will pretty soon. But in the meantime, you know, my concern over somebody who has very high levels of this has to do with their overall atherosclerosis risk for, like, you know, coronary disease of the heart, cerebrovascular disease in the brain, things like that. And I'm going to treat their other risk factors a lot more aggressively. And then the other thing, which we haven't mentioned yet, is people with high levels of this, they're also at substantially increased risk of something called aortic valve stenosis, which is a calcification, a thickening, and a narrowing of one of the valves. In fact, the main valve that lets blood come out of your heart. And so if that gets narrowed and tightened and limits the ability of blood to come out of your heart, there's a bunch of potential downstream consequences. Like, you can start passing out and you can have develop heart failure, and ultimately it can cause death in advanced stages. And this can develop because, again, you're born with this and expressing this level by age 5. You can develop aortic valve stenosis at a much earlier stage in life than people develop kind of run-of-the-mill aortic stenosis who don't have high LPA levels, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's kind of wild. Like, when I read the paper and then I did some, you know, additional reading, when I was looking at it, particularly the effect of exercise on lipoprotein little a, and you see a very similar response that you see with statins. There's like usually a slight bump, but not reliably, but in many studies they show, oh, exercise actually kind of increases lipoprotein little a, but it does significantly lower apolipoprotein B. So it's lowering total LDL levels in the blood, and it lowers those to a greater degree than LP little a is elevated. So the net, you know, outcome there is a reduced risk. But the most interesting thing, right? So people are like, what about resistance training? This is barbell medicine. Like, what the hell is resistance training do to lipoprotein little a? So there's one study, they did this in South Africa, 18 male bodybuilders, 10 of them were anabolic steroid users and 8 were non-users. And they were doing high volume resistance training, over 3,000 met minutes of resistance training per week, which that's a lot. The LP little a levels were higher than expected. So they were around 40 to 50 milligrams per deciliter, but the values were significantly higher in those who were not using anabolic steroids. And the mechanism basically they were saying is that some of the recovery processes involved from resistance training and exercise in general basically are performed by many of the anabolic agents. And so your own like inflammatory cascade and other like innate immune system function are not like taxed as heavily. And so the non-users are effectively need a higher level of LP little a to signal all of these like repair processes and remodeling processes compared to the anabolic steroid users. Now, I don't think that anybody out there with a high LP little a level should be going on anabolic, you know, androgenic steroids, but that was a really interesting story, like study that I came across. But it does also kind of corroborate the additional finding that we talked about before. Like, people on statins, if they're looking at a coronary artery calcium score, CAC score, right? If you're on statins, we know that your CAC score may increase, and that we usually use a CAC score to kind of get further refinement of like, well, how big a risk do you have for coronary artery disease, a very specific type of atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease. And if you're on statins, we know that it reduces your risk of having a major adverse cardiac event, but your CAC score may actually go up. And we're like, don't know what to do with that. Well, see the same thing with people who exercise a bunch.
Standard thing we've talked about repeatedly of paying attention to actual outcomes than these kind of intermediate kind of step things, right?
Yeah. Which leads me to the last point on this lipoprotein little a. It seems like this is like a one and done thing. You test it once and effectively you're trying to figure out like what somebody's risk profile is, and like follow-up would like only be sort of like a follow-up measurement of that particular type of lipid would only be indicated if you are using like a PCSK9 inhibitor or something else, and you're trying to see like, am I getting a therapeutic effect based on the dosing, based on the agent I'm using, et cetera. But otherwise, you're kind of like, well, I figured out what it was before, and now we're kind of doing stuff about it.
Yeah, at least that's the state of the guidance that we have currently would be, if you check it once, you know, at some point and it's low risk range, then yes, you're done. if it's high risk, then I agree that if you're not doing anything specifically to change that level, then you probably still don't need to check it again. You should just very aggressively handle all the other risk factors that you can. However, if you do end up on any kind of a treatment that is intended to lower that, be it a PCSK9 inhibitor, or again, in the coming years, if we have any of these new Lp(a) lowering therapies that I expect will come out, then sure, that would be a situation where the guidance would change and say, hey, monitor these to see whether you're getting the effect, just like people do with regular cholesterol panels to see if the treatment's getting them to kind of goal targets and things like that. But as you mentioned before, I mean, based on the genetic data we have, it seems that you need pretty large reductions in lipoprotein little a levels to get a really meaningful decrease in risk. And so again, these like kind of much smaller fluctuations that have been observed in research in these levels, be it related to, you know, dietary fat content or exercise or statin fluctuations or something, it's really difficult to interpret how much that means. Probably not a ton, and probably not something that's clinically meaningful compared to what we hopefully will see when we're able to impact these levels much more significantly. But I think that, you know, that some of the take homes are, yes, get it. You know, I've been checking one time in my patients, and definitely in those who I have some patients who have had early onset aortic valve stenosis. And in those people, I have one who I I believe it was in his 50s, developed aortic valve stenosis and checked, and lipoprotein A level was elevated. And so we're treating, even though his regular cholesterol panel, his LDL cholesterol, it was not, you know, crazy high risk range, we're treating that very aggressively to try to get as much of his residual risk, under control as possible. And so that's kind of how I'm handling things in practice. And again, I expect that this is going to evolve in the coming years as we get more therapeutics, as we get more data, things like that. But I think it's definitely at a point where, hey, this is a concerning enough risk factor that, as people may guess from some of our prior content, it takes a lot for me to say anything relating to screening that I would do.
That's true.
So I've kind of reached that point with this one myself. So,
so are you going to get yours checked?
At some point.
Yeah. I'm convinced my regular lipid panel was unremarkable.
Super low. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and let's hope you're not a Bob Harper type, huh?
I know. They're like, dude, you're LBA. I'm like, no. Yeah. That would be interesting. Be a good YouTube video. It'd get a lot of clicks. Yeah. But okay. So this has been episode 191 here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast with Dr. Austin Baraki. All of the links to the papers, the resources, the LPA clinical guidance.com, all that stuff is in the description below, our three-part cholesterol series, etc. So check those out. And, we'll be back next week and every week here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast. Dr. Baraki, thank you for joining us. What, all right, I mean, you crushed it. You did it. You're basically, I want to induct you into the European Society of Cardiology.
Oh, man, what an honor.
Can we get you? Can we get you in that? Just Dayspring, Baraki. That works. Very cool. All right. Well, this has been the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. Again, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. Thanks to Dr. Baraki for joining us. Listen to us next week and every week right here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast. Before you go anywhere, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast so we can keep bringing you all the latest nuance in health and fitness. We'll see you guys later. Bye.